And in addition to the Smart Schools thing I'm working in now, we are involved in the Charlotte Scholarship Fund, which we also have in North Carolina, that we'll hear about later today. Delighted to have a great panel with us today, and I wanted to take just a few moments to set up our topic, History, Politics of School Choice, because it is a very great debate about policy throughout the country. Depending on where you're from, you've probably got different aspects of choice being discussed and debated, because it is growing very rapidly. Critical to this issue is public understanding, and understanding of not just the issue, but the interests of the groups involved. And how this issue is discussed and debated does matter in determining not so much whether educational change is going to happen through more choice, because that is happening already, but rather how fast the landscape is going to change and how far. The public is generally supportive of choice, depending on how you ask questions, but largely they're unclear over really what the definitions of it are. So there is an opportunity to define the issue, so to speak. Discontent with public education is growing throughout the country. Every public opinion poll that you see lists public education as number one as an issue that people want decided through our political leadership. Rhetoric is very high, and in fact, even though it's not a federal issue, I'm sure we're all going to see a lot of debate at the presidential level this next time about what we do in education. Choice is bringing together a lot of different coalitions. It's not a traditional liberal, conservative, Democrat-Republican issue necessarily. It's bringing together different types of coalitions. And there are essentially four basic approaches to choice and structural change that we're seeing happen throughout the country in various states that are growing. One is public school choice in the form of charter schools. We now have over 30 states with charter school laws, over 1,000 charter schools. President Clinton wants 3,000 charter schools by 2002, and other leaders such as John Kerry, the senator from Massachusetts, have advocated charter schools as well. Tax credits is an issue that we'll hear discussed a little bit today, not necessarily on our panel, but later we'll hear, I think, something about what's happening in Arizona, where they do have tax credits. They also have them in Minnesota. Michigan has a ballot initiative underway there with school choice, yes. And the Illinois House just passed a bill for tax credits this week. Private scholarships for poor children through the Children's Scholarship Fund, CEO America movement is growing with strong bipartisan support throughout the country. You'll hear more about the CSF program, I think, later today. And then also the public voucher programs, the Cleveland program, which you're familiar with, you'll hear one of our panelists discuss today. I think Clint Bullitt may talk about Milwaukee later today. Governors in Pennsylvania and New Mexico have recently introduced their own choice plans. In Florida and Texas this week are actually debating choice voucher bills in their legislatures. One interesting note, politically speaking, before I introduce the panelists, we saw in Florida this week, that kind of is indicative of how this debate transpires. Governor Bush there in Florida had proposed, as part of his educational reform plan, a small provision for sending children to failing schools to give them an opportunity to have a voucher. That has been a very small part. I suspect it's as few as small four schools in the larger bill that's moving this week. The NEA has been running ads on radio and newspapers to call the governor's office, so that's definitely an issue in Florida. We're very honored today to have some outstanding panelists with us. I'm going to introduce them in order, and if they could just come up and speak after each other, that would be great. Our first speaker will be Andrew Coulson. Andrew is a Seattle-based writer and editor. He's Senior Research Associate of the Social Philosophy and Policy Center. He's recently written a book called Market Education, The Unknown History, which you can see outside. It has endorsements from people like Milton Friedman, William Raspberry, Paul Peterson, and others. He also edits a website called schoolchoices.org, which talks about education reform issues. Prior to getting involved in education policy, he was a computer software engineer with Microsoft, where he was involved in writing part of Windows 95. Second, we'll hear today from Dow Lawrence. Dow has a master's degree in history from Ohio State University. He was president of the Toledo Federation of Teachers for 30 years. He taught at the Gilbert's High School in Toledo, and his wife, is Francine, is now president of the union. He is formerly an AFT vice president and was president of the Toledo area AFL-CIO from 1992 to 1998. He also is currently a board member of the Convention Center here, so we need to be willing to, well, let him, thank him for letting us be here today. Richard Leonardi is president of the Buckeye Institute for Public Policy Solutions, an Ohio market-based research organization. Mr. Leonardi speaks frequently to national and state audiences on issues related to school reform and public policy innovation, and his essays have been published throughout Ohio and the country. He is a graduate of Capital University Law School in Columbus and holds a Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Dayton. And while in law school, he served as a charter member and president of the Federalist Society. He lives in Cincinnati, and we'll hear from him. And also, we're going to have Fannie Lewis with us today, who is an active and outspoken member of Ward 7 in Cleveland, where she is a member of the city council. And she is very active in many community affairs related to senior citizens, teenagers, housing, and perhaps one of the more passionate programs is the being one of the leaders in the voucher program in Cleveland, and she will talk with us about that today. So we'll ask our panelists to spend 10 or 12 minutes with their comments, and then we'll have adequate time for questions. Andrew.
Well, I think that most people involved in the school choice issue would agree. The debate sometimes gets a little heated, but it's been a heat that hasn't produced a whole lot of light. Over the last decade, probably two decades, there really has been essentially a deadlock between proponents of school choice and critics of school choice. Most of the arguments in favor of school choice have been principally theoretical, often from economics, or have drawn analogies to other industries, or have been based on small-scale experiments with school choice, voucher experiments, charter school experiments. A lot of these arguments have considerable merit, but they can also be attacked reasonably on a variety of grounds. Critics of school choice point out, I think reasonably, that an entirely theoretical argument is perhaps something of a shaky basis for a dramatic change in the way we educate our kids. Analogies to other industries are often dismissed out of hand. A lot of people suggest that maybe education is different from other industries. And to say that the market incentives which work wonderfully in the computer industry just may not carry over into education. Maybe educators won't respond to these incentives. As I think we'll hear later on today, voucher experiments and the research based on them and charter school research is very hotly debated. Often there are papers on both sides, whether it's regarding academic achievement or parental satisfaction. So I think both sides are eager to find some large body of evidence that's very compelling, against which they can test their ideas and each other's arguments. Well, the funny thing is, there has been just such a massive body of evidence, very relevant evidence, right behind us all along. And it's the 2,500-year history of education. Our ancestors have tried more and different ways of educating their kids than most people realize, and what we don't know about their experiences is hurting us. So what does the evidence show? Well, most relevant for today's conference, it shows that competitive markets for education, where parents can choose any school for their kids, and teachers, anyone can become a teacher, teachers can teach anything they like, they have to compete for the opportunity to serve children. Markets like this are not new and they're not untried. In fact, they've been tried repeatedly over the last 25 centuries, from classical Athens in the 5th and 4th centuries BC, in the Roman Republic, in the early medieval Muslim Empire, in early 19th century England and the United States, and even in modern Japan, in the private for-profit market for after-school schools. Well, and not only have markets been tried, but they work. Consider the case of classical Athens. Most people are aware that it was a great contributor to the rise of Western culture, if not the inventor of Western culture. Fewer people are aware that the classical Athenians had no government role in education whatsoever. And yet, they became the most literate, the most well-educated, the most broadly and most broad and diverse culture, and perhaps the economic superpower of the Mediterranean in their time, and if not the superpower of the world, economically and culturally. But of course, critics can point out that perhaps in Athens, literacy and schooling didn't reach the overwhelming majority of the population, or they reached a large portion, but not the overwhelming majority. And a lot of people have suggested over the years that state-run schools with mandatory attendance laws are a requirement if we are to see widespread literacy and enrollment in schooling. I've looked at the historical evidence, and that doesn't appear to be the case. Both England and the United States achieved near universal elementary school enrollment and very widespread literacy well before state-run schools were established in either country. And it's interesting to see the trends that existed from the founding of this nation on through the mid-1800s. Between the Revolution and the middle of the 19th century, consumption of newspapers tripled, the amount of money spent on books tripled, literacy rose dramatically, school enrollment rose dramatically, and the average income or the median income, I'm not sure, doubled during that period. So not a bad record, really, for a competitive market approach to education. And this nation was founded, as I said, on essentially a free market approach to education. What public schools there were tended to be really semi-public, with some tuition being charged in most schools. So what happened when the mandatory attendance laws and the state-run schools, as we know them today, were introduced in the second half of the 19th century? Well, there are enrollment figures dating back to this period, and what we see is that there was a continued modest increase in enrollment between 1850 and 1900. But the picture changes somewhat if we disaggregate the data by race. It turns out that most of the gain, if not all of the gain, was due to the fact that African Americans had, before the Civil War, before emancipation, been forbidden by law to become educated or literate. And it was only after the Civil War that blacks were allowed to attend schools in the South and in parts of the North, and as a result, their enrollment in schooling rose dramatically. Rose by something like 38% in just a decade or two decades around the Civil War. So that leaves us with the enrollment of whites. As it turns out, the enrollment of whites declined by 2.6% between 1850 and 1900, when public schools and mandatory attendance laws were spreading throughout most of this nation. But what's interesting is that the superiority of competitive market approaches to education over state-run school systems has extended beyond mundane issues such as literacy or basic enrollment. It extends even into areas which are the raison d'etre of the public school system. Things like social harmony and making sure that all kids, regardless of family income, have access to good schools. Consider the social harmony issue. We're all sort of led to believe that public schools are a unifying force in communities. They help us to build cohesive communities, stronger democracy. Well, on the whole, that's not what the historical record shows. We have been fighting over a wide variety of issues in our public schools since the public schools were founded. The issue of school prayer that we continue to fight about today has been around since the inception of public schooling. Creation versus evolution in the public schools has been a vitriolic debate for more than 80 years. We seem to be adding new subjects for vicious debate in the public schools with every generation. We now have the naming of public schools as something that brings communities into turmoil. School uniforms, the textbook selection, textbook censorship, the list is just endless. Remarkably, a lot of this conflict is actually caused by the state operation of schools. And the reason is fairly simple. When there is one official organ, government organ of education, and when everyone is required to pay for this government education, everyone naturally wants to reflect their own views and to reject the views that they oppose. It's perfectly natural, but in a pluralistic society, it's impossible. The only way that you can have your views espoused in the public schools is at the expense of some other group. And the end-of-school wars that we've seen in this country are the natural result. Markets are typically criticized on these very grounds, that they would produce a factionalization of the public and that they would prove divisive. Well, the historical evidence points in just the opposite direction. When people can pursue both their shared educational goals and their unique religious, cultural, or ethnic traditions in their schooling, they tend not to be thrown into conflict with each other because there's no coercion. They can pursue both their areas of agreement and difference without coming into conflict. And so competitive markets, even in very diverse societies, have led to quite harmonious school systems. Classical Athens had a massive immigrant population. There were vibrant minority Jewish and Christian populations in the early medieval Muslim empire. And these did not generate conflict over the free market approach to schooling that they had. Today, you just don't see kids from evangelical Christian schools picketing outside of Muslim academies or synagogue schools, demanding that they adopt the King James Version of the Bible. I mean, it just doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen because there's an absence of coercion and people can basically get the things they want. So to sum up, I'd just like to stress that the evidence we've been looking for to help resolve the school choice debate exists. And we continue to ignore this historical evidence at our peril and at the peril of our children. Thanks very much.
On behalf of the Seagate Center, Convention Center, to Toledo, we're happy to have you here. Those of us from the north coast of Ohio are very proud of our part of the country. Despite our contentious nature here, we're only sorry that we couldn't give you a little better weather. But March is when we all go to Florida, and maybe next week. Somehow I feel like I'm the designated devil incarnate here today. You're looking at the person who has destroyed public education. I've been a teacher union president for 30 years, and all of the evils of public schools you can probably attribute to me. However, like so many things about this whole discussion of choice, there is a great difference between perceptions and the facts and reality. For instance, in my own case, I'm a father of four children who graduated from Toledo Public Schools and have done quite well, incidentally, I'm very proud of. I have grandchildren in Toledo Public Schools. I wouldn't think of sending them to a private school because they're getting an excellent education right here in our public school, the urban school system, the fourth largest in the state of Ohio. The choice discussion really needs some light and a little less heat. For instance, I'm not opposed to choice. I am opposed to choice the way it's being implemented in this state. And my comments will be primarily about the state of Ohio, not about your state, although I have read some things about other states. But I know a little bit about the state of Ohio and have been participating in that whole process and discussion over a number of years. Chris Whittle, for instance, has said that we ought to take a look at communicating better with the teacher union, the NEA and the AFT. We're part of the AFT here in Toledo. Because those unions, those national unions, have not yet made a final decision about, for instance, charter schools and the whole choice issue. And obviously, if I had been satisfied with the way public schools operate, I would have joined the union 35 years ago when I was teaching here in Toledo. And I will freely admit that during the first part of my discussion, when I talk about the unfortunate anti-union sentiment that choice people seem to hold and proclaim, I am in effect saying to people in the choice community that yes, there are serious problems in public schools. They do need correction. I disagree or I question whether or not we're going about that correction appropriately. Also, I want to say that in Ohio, the whole choice argument is pretty much a look at the Republican Party, not the Democratic Party. It's kind of a revealing insight into the stresses within the Republican Party itself. I don't think, for instance, that the Democrats control the governor's office and the Ohio House of Representatives and the Ohio Senate and the Supreme Court, as the Republicans currently do. I don't think we would have either vouchers or charter school legislation in the state. Now, that is not to say that there are not advocates among Democrats for charters and for vouchers. Indeed, there were, particularly those representatives from the city of Cleveland when George Voinovich put the voucher program in. And that's not to say that there are not advocates and opponents on both sides of the aisle so far as charters are concerned. But there are four basic things that bother me about the discussion of choice. One is that the anti-union animus that I mentioned. The other is a competition theory or argument that is used to justify choice. And the other is the very close relationship between those who advocate for religious education and those who advocate for charters and for vouchers. Choice advocates seem to suggest that school boards and school superintendents have an enormous number of ingenious ideas for improving public education, but they're afraid to announce them or can't carry them out because of the teacher unions and other unions. I want to tell you that in 30-some years as president of teachers union, I did not meet one time one single ingenious idea from a school board member or a superintendent. Pete Silberman, notwithstanding, because Pete is on our school board now and he just came in. Hi, Peter. I've worked with dozens of them, and I don't say that maliciously. I say that very factually from my point of view. And there's nothing in my 38 years of experience that would suggest that students would learn more or better if their teachers weren't unionized. The salaries and benefits, it sure would be somewhat lower, but so would the quality of the teaching staff be lower. And the truth of the matter is, in my experience, if we didn't have unionized teachers in our city schools today, those city schools would be worse, not better. For one thing, we are the only people that have had a continuity over a long period of time. Superintendents and school boards come and go, but the teachers and their union, and in education, the union is really their professional organization, a professional association. We're the ones who provide the continuity. I work, for instance, with 9 different superintendents and probably close to 90 school board members over that period of time that I was president of the teachers union. And also, it's interesting that there are about 30 urban teacher unions in the country, and Toledo is one of them, that are funded by the Pew Charitable Trust and the MacArthur Foundation because they looked at us as a potential way to begin to reform public education, urban education. Incidentally, when we're talking about charters and vouchers and choice and so forth, basically, at least in this state, we're not talking about suburban schools, we're not talking about rural schools, we're talking about city schools or urban education. Competition argument, they say, will jumpstart public education, but I don't think the facts support that either. There's very little choice for school boards in this state. There is a teacher shortage, and the marketplace in the private sector is much different than the marketplace in the education sector, which we could get into in the question and answer periods. But public schools end up losing money, and we end up with the most difficult kids to educate and the most expensive to educate. And the people who are coming in under the choice theory, the charter school people and the voucher people, can't afford to teach those who are most difficult and still show a profit. Vouchers and charters, for the most part, separate the best, and they label the rest. And those of us in public schools in urban areas, we get the rest. And I think that spells over the long term some serious problems for our democratic society. We're not like Belgium, for all Belgians are Belgian. We are a very diverse kind of society. The competition theory had any merit would have to be proven on a level playing field, and that rarely exists, as you know if you've read about some of the charter voucher experiments. The Cleveland voucher experiment is a lesson, I think, for all of us. At the outset of the second term, Governor Voinovich proposed a limited $5 million voucher experiment to help kids escape what he considered to be terrible Cleveland public schools, and I'm sure there were some of them that were certainly not as good as they should be. Politically, Voinovich could say that he had straddled the fence on vouchers, with it only related to one school system. And for the rest of us, he could say that he did as little as possible. We endorsed him when he first ran for office. He walked into my office off the street unannounced and said, "I need your help." We had sat down and had a long conversation about education in Ohio and how he would fit into it. I was frustrated with the Democrats at that point, very frustrated with them. We talked about choice. And he said to me, "I will guarantee you, that if I'm elected, at least during my first term, I will not be involved with vouchers." And I was influential in turning our state union around and endorsing George Voinovich. And indeed, he was true to his word. During that first term, but he did towards the end tell us that he would not or could not hold talk with voucher people any longer. His largest fundraiser is a man named David Brennan in Akron. And David Brennan is a wealthy person in industrials, but he also now owns about 12 private schools in a separate corporation, somewhat euphemistically called Hope Academies. And he is he raised $1 million for Voinovich. He's his number one fundraiser. And his $1 million certainly outweighed our arguments that the vouchers and charges were a bad public policy and not a good idea for Ohio. Brennan has testified in Columbus that he believes that at least 20% of the kids in Ohio ought to be in private schools, and that unionized teachers make education too expensive. My favorite Brennan quote is this: "I have never considered it radical to suggest that a market-oriented education system is superior to a state-run monopoly." It's my favorite because he uttered that before the state proficiency scores came in. Brennan is also a person who contributed $50,000 to Newt Gingrich's Go Back and $49,000 to help fund Proposition 226 in California, which would have restricted the right of public employees to participate in the political process. According to the state auditor, who is a Republican, Cleveland vouchers 3 years later will cost $15 million. One half of the voucher recipients were already enrolled in the church schools there in Cleveland. And over 30 families have incomes exceeding $50,000 a year, despite the fact that the program was sold to a very reluctant legislature as a way to help poor families escape Cleveland schools and attend a church school, which supposedly was better. It passed the Ohio House by a vote in 1995 and Senate by a vote of 57-41 and a somewhat bipartisan commission. We then sued to stop the program, and that suit is now before the Ohio Supreme Court. Meanwhile, the Cleveland schools have lost $5 million in state funds, which would have been earmarked for needy children, and two independent audits have concluded that test results aren't any different between the church school voucher kids in Cleveland and the public school Cleveland kids. And frankly, I'm not about to give my tax dollars if I can help it to Fannie Lewis so she can send her kids to church school. Fannie, of course, will tell you just the opposite in a little bit. What is revealing, however, is that David Brennan's two Hope Academies in Cleveland finished dead last among all public and private schools in Cleveland on Ohio's proficiency test. And his school is now under investigation by the U.S. Office of Education for failure to develop IEPs as is required by federal law. Governor Taft, in the meantime, has said that he wants to see results before expanding the voucher experiment. So, besides those who think that there's a profit in choice, who in Ohio are those people who have captured the heart and soul of the Republican leadership? I say leadership because rural Republicans and some suburban Republicans don't give a hoot about vouchers or charters. But at the same time, they don't mind punishing those of us in the city schools, most of, in their view, kids, evil, and money are at anyway. Vouchers and charters are not going to bother rural people because they aren't about to give up their football and basketball programs for a bunch of largely suburban charterites running around kicking a soccer ball. And if you think there's another reason why charters and vouchers won't work in rural Ohio, you're dead wrong. There is something else the charter crowd wants besides profits and a go in a union, though. Many tend to be conservative in their religious views, predominantly Christians, and they believe that public schools are godless institutions responsible for drugs, crime, poverty, taxes, sex, and pro-choice, as in pro-abortion. Some sort of philosophical paradox there. And if those of us who are in the public schools are not responsible, we're certainly very close to those problems. So we are sitting ducks for what ails society. Vouchers would not pass the Republican-controlled legislature if they were to be used in rural or suburban districts. It is doubtful if charters and vouchers are any more than a reflection of the degree to which mainline Republicans have had to bend to the narrow interest of its disgruntled religious faction. Ohio's charter school law is a catch-22. Incidentally, it is a public school law. You can't use the charter or the charter money to create a church school, for instance. Ohio's funding formula for public schools has been declared unconstitutional because it's inadequate, inequitable, and relies too heavily on property taxes, all of which are true. The judge who heard the case is a Republican, and the Ohio Supreme Court is controlled by Republicans. And so far, the Republican-controlled legislature has failed to pass a reform that's acceptable to the courts. This is the catch-22. This is the same legislature that has aimed charter school legislation at city schools in Ohio, while at the same time shortchanging them. I know the Toledo schools are underfunded by about 30%, because the kinds of projects and experiments we've run and gotten excellent results from student tests are not replicable, because we don't have the money to replicate them. And this is a city district that has passed tax issues, even though we have an eroding tax base, and incidentally our teacher pay is low, seventh among the large cities and below the average of the state. I met with the chief sponsor of Ohio's charter school law. She's from Toledo. She is a well-known booster of church schools in her district. If she walked into a public school, she wouldn't be recognized. She basically ignores them. Like so many of the choice advocates, she shows no understanding what needs to be fixed in urban schools and was largely unsympathetic to the idea of fixing what needs to be fixed anyway. Competition was her solution or excuse. I personally thought that her real motive was to make it easier for kids to go to church schools. She did not have an easy time getting her bill passed, and initially the charter law applied only to this county, although subsequently the legislature has expanded it to other city districts. So what we have is Ohio legislators who have been willing to spend at least $20 million so far chasing solutions to problems that it doesn't understand and too often isn't even interested in. The simple solution is to declare public schools, city public schools, failures, and turn the education of thousands of our kids over to profit-minded amateurs with agendas clearly out of step with the public at large. They're not people to whom I would entrust my children's education. Indeed, frankly, I doubt if they could tell you what a student should be able to do upon graduation from a high school. So the great political question we face is whether the public in the long run will be satisfied to pay taxes to improve the bottom line of people whose agendas would further splinter and factionalize our society and our form of government. Rather than give up on public schools and public education, we ought to repair them and then encourage those who desire more exposure to such things as objectivity, critical thinking, facts, diversity, to seek out their private schools without yours or my tax dollars.
In the introduction, I used to run and started a student chapter of the Federalist Society at the Capital University Law School. So it's a real thrill to be able to talk to you today. I got a call Monday essentially informing me that Mike Fox, the former head of the House Education Committee, couldn't make it. He scheduled a conflict in Alaska, and so was called and asked to work with him. So I put some remarks together for you. In addressing the problem of education reform, it's easy to forget how novel the problem is in human history. It's novel because public schooling itself, as we currently know it, is novel and new. In all of human history before this century, the main mechanisms used to prepare new generations for adulthood were the home and the church, and different churches. In the last century, public schools began to appear here and there, consisting almost exclusively of one-room schoolhouses, but at the time, attendance was optional, and it was unusual for children to have as much formalized and structured schooling as they have now. Abraham Lincoln, for instance, universally hailed, a learned man and one of the great presidents, was really a proto-home schooler. He learned how to read and write primarily by reading the Bible and the collected works of William Shakespeare. He learned law from Blackstone's commentaries. He was, in some sense, self-taught. Early in this century, and actually late in the last century, the idea took hold that we should do what Prussia did. compel parents to give custody of their children to the state for several hours a day, year after year, for education, indoctrination, and promotion of patriotism. This became the norm in this country by about 1910 to 1920. And what was going on in 1910, 1920, before that? A whole lot of immigration. Only the immigration then was a little different than it was in the past. There were a lot of immigrants from places like Eastern and Southern Europe with names like Leonardo. These folks spoke a little differently, acted a little differently, had different customs, tended to set up their own schools and churches often enough. There is a tendency in America, which Tocqueville identified in the early 19th century, to look askance at difference sometimes, what we now call diversity. These folks were different. They didn't quite fit into the stereotypical view of America. So there was a quest for more uniformity, and that is one of the ways that public schooling, as we currently know it, was sold to the public. We will assimilate these folks much more uniformly. You may think that's a laudable goal, but there was a whole lot of bigotry that went on at that time in its promotion. For instance, Catholics. There was a lot of anti-Catholic bashing. The term Papists was thrown around as a slur against Catholics. You know, unfortunately, when we tend to mold old social engineering and blend that with state coercion, it often leads to bad results, some of which I'll get to in a minute. So the mass mandatory education system established then is essentially the same one we have today, although that's beginning to change. The 70 years or so that have passed since then is hardly the wink of an eye when you compare it to the centuries that went before. Andrew's book, for instance, compares how we ran schooling as far as 2,500 years ago. Mass mandatory schooling in state-managed schools is not the historical norm in America or really anywhere else. Instead, it's a huge and a very recent experiment. The experiment has taken almost exactly the same shape everywhere it's been tried. In every state and country where government has given itself the role of transmitting the culture, the method used has been for the government to build and manage school buildings, for the government to hire and pay teachers and administrators, and for the government to decide what subjects will be taught and how they will be taught, the source of a lot of contentious debate, most certainly. It has almost become a cliche to criticize the government for too often using a one-size-fits-all approach, but that cliche is nowhere more true than in public schooling. It's the same everywhere for everyone, more or less. So how successful has that vast experiment in social engineering been? To answer that, we need to know how to measure success in teaching. The philosopher Immanuel Kant, who was a teacher for most of his life, measured his own success by the performance of his less gifted pupils. The reason being that the more gifted ones would succeed as students no matter how ineptly they've been taught. Most of you folks are lawyers and have advanced degrees. Were this a gulag instead of a conference hall, you'd probably still learn something. Well, that doesn't necessarily apply to everyone. If we apply Kant's measure, there's no escaping the conclusion that our experiment with mass mandatory schooling is a failure, especially for those that Kant would say we need to measure, those that are least advantaged. No one denies that many public school systems regularly turn out well-educated students. But these tend to be the schools in affluent districts whose students come into the system with the built-in advantage of better-educated parents. These are the schools whose students will succeed no matter how good or bad a job the schools do. If we focus instead on the less advantaged student, as Kahn said we should, then there is simply no escaping the conclusion that by any sane measure, public schooling has been a tragic and colossal failure. You've all heard the dark and worsening statistics, and I'll recount a few of them for you. Significant percentages of high school students who cannot read, a rate of illiteracy higher than it was in the 19th century before the state began its experiment with mass mandatory education. More than half of all U.S. high school students, not just poor ones, who cannot locate places like Nicaragua on a map, who don't know the decade in which the Civil War was fought, and who don't know how a bill becomes a law in a legislature. Math and science achievement levels significantly lower than most of other industrialized countries. Standardized test scores lower than they were in the 1960s. African American median test scores lower than they were during the Jim Crow era before 1954. The figures can go on and on. That's just something of a snapshot for you. Nowhere is it worse than in urban low-income districts. In Ohio's biggest public school district, Cleveland, only one out of 14 eighth graders goes on to graduate on time with senior level academic proficiency. Not a very good statistic. That's the same proportion of students who are victimized by crime every year in these same schools. 14 to 25 school buildings there, depending on whose statistics you consider, are beyond repair and have been recommended for abandonment and condemnation. More than 600 building and fire code violations in the Cleveland schools were on file as of 1996, some of the violations having gone unaddressed for over 10 years. In 1995, the Cleveland School District had exhausted an enormous budget of about $500 million. It was about $125 million in debt, and it caused a federal judge to put the whole system into receivership from which it's emerging. Bear in mind that in the face of all this, by law, Cleveland parents are obligated to send their children to these places and to these appalling conditions and give custody of their children for 6 hours a day to the people who managed what by any measure, again, is a failed system. But there's one respect in which the experiment with mass mandatory one-size-fits-all education has been a roaring success. It has succeeded in creating one of the most firmly entrenched, best-funded interest groups in the country. In the past 50 years, despite the declining performance of schools, the amount of money spent nationwide on K-12 education, even adjusting for inflation, has increased by 14 times. And the enormous numbers of people to whom that money is paid have a powerful interest in keeping the money flowing. The Ohio Education Association is today the largest public employee labor union in the state. It has more than 117,000 members. In the private sector, of course, the unions have seen a decline in membership and dues, but the OEA's coffers are filling even higher. However, while those coffers are filling, a lot of teachers really just aren't seeing the benefits, the people that the unions purport to represent. For instance, between 1996 and 1997, Ohio's teacher salaries in public schools grew 2.6%, roughly the rate of inflation, so in some senses they stayed the same. But OEA union staff compensation for that same period, these are the folks that represent the union members, increased by 7.8% to an average of about $91,000 annually in compensation. And compensation for the top 25, the upper echelon, top 25% of OEA staffers and union lobbyists over the same period grew by 23.5%. That's over nine times faster than the people that they claim to represent. Now, you hear a whole lot about the private sector having all these employer-employee divisions regarding pay scales, you know, managers making too much, workers making too little. Well, it's interesting that unionization, specifically the Ohio Education Association, has that trend embedded within it as well, and perhaps more so. So for the people who are actually receiving all the money we are spending on public schools, the experiment in mass mandatory schooling has been a positive boon. So although our public school system has failed to provide even a minimal education for those most in need of one, and again, my remarks are primarily addressed at urban education, because that tends to be where these reforms have been promoted the most aggressively, it succeeded in creating one of the most powerful special interest groups in Ohio. And therein lies the biggest obstacle to meaningful reform. We have created a system that gives tens of thousands of the best Ohioans, namely teachers, a strong incentive to preserve the status quo. There's only one quote-unquote reform that often passes muster with the $101,000 a year lobbyist for the teachers, and that's putting more money into the system. Statistic after statistic has shown that that really has no bearing on achievement. Across the board, increases in expenditure just don't translate into boosted achievement. If it did, we'd see a 14-fold boost in achievement test scores over the past 50 years to match the spending that's gone up by that amount. It's a contagious notion, though, that boosting spending will lead to better achievement. It's a bipartisan sentiment. Governor Bob Taft, in his State of the State address, crowed about the fact that he is going to quadruple the rate of inflation in terms of new education spending. Union lobbyists appear to be fully capable of persuading leaders in both parties. It's a bipartisan issue. Anyone can see that what we need is fundamental root and branch reform, and that's what you're starting to see in other panels that they can address very adequately. But even the baby step reforms that have been proposed in recent years have run into insuperable opposition. Even a simple baby step, like changing the tenure system and tying teachers' pay to performance, is met with outrage by many union lobbyists. Statewide proficiency testing, another baby step reform, was enacted despite a lot of foot dragging by teachers' unions. But many school administrations have neutralized that particular reform by simply teaching the test, something of a shortcut. And when the General Assembly tried to address the tragedy in the Cleveland Public Schools by creating a program that sends dollars to parents instead of the bureaucracy that was mismanaging it, some of the most vicious attacks in Ohio political history went on and still reverberate to this day. So vicious were those attacks that it basically limited the program to a few thousand Ohio families, Cleveland families specifically, despite the fact that there's others that are pleading for expansion. We can argue whether things like tenure reform, proficiency tenure, and vouchers are worthwhile goals. And many reasonable people take different points of view on those things. But our experiment with these reform efforts shows that real fundamental change, breaking the mold, so to speak, is going to be very, very difficult moving forward. I hate to end on a pessimistic note. I'm not pessimistic. I wouldn't do what I do if I was. There are real heroes out there that are working to change the system. The Children's Scholarship Fund now has expanded into Ohio to serve low-income students with privately funded scholarships in Toledo, in Dayton, in Cincinnati. Fannie Lewis will tell you about her work with the Cleveland Voucher Program, and she fought courageously to help promote that program. She's one of the heroes featured in the Green Study, Giving Choice a Chance, which we distributed to many of you. So there are some real heroes out there. But as long as schooling remains a government function, it's going to be a plaything of political forces. He who pays the piper calls the tune. The people with the greatest economic incentives will be the people most likely to prevail in the political fights that lie ahead. One lesson might be for reform-minded people to commit themselves to fighting within the political process that much harder, outspending the lobbyists for the status quo. But another lesson, and a different way of looking at this, and one that the Buckeye Institute is starting to look at, might be that education simply shouldn't be part of the political process in the first place. It's simply too important to leave in the hands of government. Perhaps we can begin to see the solution to our education woes by stepping back and looking at what we did before we began this failed experiment with mass mandatory government school. Thanks.
Good morning. My name is Fannie M. Lewis, and I am a legislator for the Cleveland City Council from the most deprived area called Huff. And I say to my dear friend here, to my left, is that snakes warn you before they strike you. Your lawyers out there, I guess most of your lawyers, right? Are you? Then you may have a case here this morning. You want to represent me because he said something that's not true in his document. And let me see, one of the problems with choice and with the education in the public schools is that people don't give off the truth. See, it's the truth of the matter that we have to worry about. Now, I came here to say something else, but he's changed my whole speech. And it's about what's true. Now, I'm a product of the Huff community. I came from Memphis, Tennessee to get away from segregation. And I ran into it in Cleveland, in Huff. And I had five children. And two of them were old enough to go to Cleveland Public Schools. And the oldest youngster did not graduate from Cleveland Public Schools because it had a school with 2,700 youngsters in it. And he had to sit on the windowsill with no books in order to have a seat. And I had to stay in that school all day long to talk to the teachers who didn't want to talk to me because they didn't understand why I didn't understand why they couldn't teach my son. Now, I lost my son to the street and I'm still working with him now. He's 54. Went in and out of institutions. Now, that's what the teachers union and people who are against education for children, they want them in institutions. And where are they? Because we've lost 40% to 60% of the product, and where are they? They're in the jails because we didn't educate them. Now, he says I'm sending my kids to public school. The history on that is I have a daughter who did graduate from high school and college. But got hooked on drugs. Now, if you've never known drugs in your family, then you're blessed and you're lucky. And she had five children, and as a grandmother, who didn't want to see my kids go every kind of way. Now you hear this. because you didn't come to me and ask me before you put the story out here. I didn't want to see my youngsters tied up into a human service system in Cleveland going to foster homes never to see each other no more. So at 67 years old, now you know I got to be crazy, and I am totally nuts. I took in 5 youngsters. The oldest one was 14, 12, 11, a newborn, and a 1-year-old. And those are the youngsters that I'm educating now. I sent my 5 to public school, my children. Early, Carl, Wayne, can't think of the name of the other two. Okay. But I'm incensed at the false information that goes out. And it's bad enough to give out false information, but to give it out in front of the person who you're talking about is really crazy. My 4 children graduated from Cleveland Public Schools. My 2 boys went to Kent State, and I had to go to Kent State. They stayed on probation at Kent State for 4 semesters. They wanted to send my boys home because they didn't know how to study, how to adjust, and how to get down to learning how to study in college. And I had to go down and take the dean on to keep them down in Kent because I didn't want them backing up. Now, I've been through the Cleveland public system. I've got some products at home that went through there. And I keep them at home. I let Diggity Dog educate them before I put them in the Cleveland Public School without it being revised to where it is now. And the teachers union is who's afraid of the Virginia back, the Virginia world. I'm not. They contribute more to campaign for elected officials to fight choice than anybody else I know. C.J. Prentice, who's an elected official, whose husband is with the Cleveland Teachers Union, who is and a black woman, supposed to be, in a district where 90% of the youngsters are black in the school, and the school system is losing 60% of the kids, and she's against choice. She's against charter. Jeffrey Johnson, another state senator, black down in Columbus, telling Barnaby that black folks in their district don't want no voucher. Now, I happen to be in a lawyer's office one day because of a fight in my neighborhood and happened to see a booklet that said voucher. And I do a lot of reading. And I picked it up and I read it. I said, this sounds like what we need in my neighborhood to help us to get a better education for our children. So I read it and I began to do some research and I went and I read upon Bolick, Andy was the gentleman who I finally ran into at the Buckeye Institute, and asked Andy some questions, come down and give me some answers, tell me who I can talk to. We, for a year long, we studied this thing to find out what we wanted to do with it. And I said, aha, if they can give me a welfare check, and I did end up on welfare when I came to Cleveland for a while, because I'd never lived in a city such as Cleveland. I was introduced to roaches in Cleveland. I was introduced to my first prostitute. I was introduced to my first drunk laying in front of my door sleeping. I wasn't used to that kind of lifestyle. And I had to survive because I had some children I had to live for. And I said, come up here and give me some information. Help me together this stuff. And by this time, I'm a legislator now. So I have some clout to have a voice. The only black legislator in the city of Cleveland, on the state, federal, and local level, who dared to come out and say, yes, we want it. And let me tell you about the party. It ain't a dime worth of difference between Democrats and Republicans when it comes to dollars. Not a dime worth of difference. So it's not about, Bonavich is a Republican senator now. He was the governor then. And if I can live with 51% of a person, I'll buy the 49. So I was able to talk to Vonnegut and his staff about whether or not we would be able to have this kind of thing in Cleveland and we would support it. And he said, well, you show me you want it. So Brennan, and that's another thing, you've never looked at what Brennan did. Brendan rode in on our coattails. Brendan could bust a grape out there until we came on the scene. He visited our meetings. He wanted to finance us down in Columbus. And one of the things that I say, when community people get a voice in their mind, get a thought in their mind that they want something, and they are committed and dedicated and convinced and go after their game. And I proved that in my neighborhood. I said to my people, we're going down to Columbus. How are we going to get there? Well, you go get your dollars and your dimes and your food stamps. We're going to get some buses. And we're going to pay for them ourselves. And we're going down to Columbus. And we're going to take over the state house. We're going to testify. We're going to tell them what it is that we're going through here with and what the problems we are having. Now, I don't know what all this stuff that we need to put together, but one thing we do need, we need to educate children. We need to educate them. They're entitled to being educated. And our youngsters are not getting educated because there's too much gobbledygook in between them and the teachers in getting an education. And parents are not allowed to participate, only on a limited basis. So we put together a bus, and we, 7 buses, and he didn't tell you about that. We rode down to Columbus down the highway with signs saying, have voucher wheel trap on the side of our buses. And we drove up into Columbus, and we took over the state house. We had a letter for every representative in the state house. We went to see the governor. We stayed there, and we testified all night long. We had black, white, and the Bangor mission's over in the inner city anyway, because we got integrated families. We had all kind of folks on our bus. Yes, we had some Catholic priests. We had 2 of them. And I didn't care who go. And it's just like the good Lord said, whomsoever will, let him come. As long as you come in to help. And if you're not coming to help, we'll get rid of you. And we went down and we took over our state house and we told our representatives, because I almost had to literally fight with them there. And if you know anything about that, you know that. I had to literally fight with them to be able to hold our press conference and get into the state house to see those people and pass out the letter. By the time we left there, everybody knew we'd been there. And we continued through with our follow-up, and we were able to get it. One thing that I learned, when I came to Cleveland, I knew nothing about government. But Cleveland is a place, if you don't know nothing, you will die, or it will teach you. 1 or 2. I've learned about government, I've learned how to function. And I know that government is no better than the people who are there. I'm an elected official, I don't raise money. And that's what's wrong with our elected officials. They take too much money. And they take money from the Cleveland Teachers Union. And they make sure they get it. And how do I know they got it? Because I went and pulled a campaign expense form and read it off in city council. Do your homework. And you know what the problem is. I don't take no money. People don't know I'm the best representative they had. That's their problem. And I don't make no bones about that. And the thing of it is wherever I need to go in order to talk about it, choice, vouchers, or whatever it is, to give an education to some youngsters who otherwise would not get it, I will go there. And I don't have no fear of anybody but the good Lord. What we need, what you need as lawyers is the truth. If you are with the truth, and you, the only way you know the truth is you have to go see it for yourself. Now, I could be standing here lying to you. You don't know that. But he hadn't refuted nothing I said. Then I must be telling the truth. And then he's going to talk about my grandkids, but you know, like, I'm 73 now. And raising 5 children at a second age when I ought to be going to Florida where he's going down there, you know, enjoying myself. But my children, my grandchildren are not going to school off of my income. They're going off of their mother's income. That's what they're going off of. And what I said to the welfare department down at the Human Health and Human Services Department, if you give her the check to buy drugs with, then you're going to give it to me in order to take care of it. Go check the record out. Now, the thing of it is that, you know, what we've done here in this country, we've just looked at low-income people, and especially black folks, and then we as black people are merely responsible for most of this miseducation of our children. Because we have not fought for it. The corporate structure has brought us up front and said, hey, then we get up there, we become just like the system. And we don't do nothing but perpetuate the situation. We got 10 black councilmen, a black mayor, all kind of black judges and black everything in Cleveland, and we're worse off now than we ever been. What's the problem? We're becoming the same kind of people. And my contention is, as long as I live on this earth, I got an education in the South, high school. I never went to college, but I got a Humphrey degree, and I'll match that against anybody. The thing that we do not look at people, and we do not determine the needs. When we look at people, determine the needs, and then find a way to deal with that. And it doesn't matter whether I like you or you like me, it's what do the people need, because if the people are out there and they're not getting service, it's just a matter of time before they eat into the other communities, into the other neighborhoods. Children in Huff now have moved out to Shaker, has moved out to Warrensville, has moved out to other outlying suburbs. If you don't take care of the problem in the inner city, it's just gonna spread to the outer ring. Every human being is doing this. And let me talk about this thing about religion. Religion is a duty. It's what we're supposed to do as human beings as it relates to God. And when you talk about, you don't want to mix church and state, but you know, I can deal with that if that's what you want to do. But don't let that be a hindrance to a child getting an education. Because children do not understand religion until they get to the point where they have an understanding of who God is. So why do you want to mess up their mind with not giving them a decent education? The school that we put together in Huff was called Huff Brooks Academy. Mrs. Brooks was one of our persons who persevered with me until she died for decent education in our school. Our school is not up yet. Brennan's school is up because Brennan had some money. I talked to the teachers' union about what Brennan was doing. And I don't work with Brennan because I don't want to be any more controlled by Brennan than I want to be controlled by the teachers' union determining what education is going to be. There have been 9 schools that have been independent schools that have been opened up. There's a move now to do some charter schools in the city of Cleveland. And under that, we hope to put our school. The city of Cleveland mayor, who was opposed to voucher, we had a building that we was ready to do a campus K-12, and he sent the inspectors out and said, your building is unsafe, so you can't put it in. It had a structural engineer with this stamp on it. Now, so we can't put it in the building because it's unsafe. What we need is the money to build a building, and we need to put it together. Our school, and we have everything set for our school in order to take care of our youngsters while their mothers work. Our school would open up at 6:30 in the morning and close at 9:30 at night. And we would be doing all those kinds of things to educate a child and to help that parent to educate their children while they work and try to take care of their family. A balanced mind is what we need. And you can't have a balanced mind with having false information. And what I'm saying to you is that if you can't find a place to gather your factual information on what your decision ought to be, Huff is a place you need to come to. You need to come and see what we're doing and check us out. Just as I said, I couldn't be lying to you, you don't know. But before you making a decision about listening to people like this, who's gonna get, and God helping me, you know, and I hope the Lord forgive him. The thing of it is, he needs to check his information out before he put it out there. The teachers union has been a detriment to what we've done, and all of them that I've checked out send their own biological children to private schools. And I don't have a problem with that. That's why you're working. You lose your children. You lost your end product. So send them where you need to send them to get the best education. I don't hold that against them. But my Lord helps to educate those youngsters out there who don't have mothers and fathers at home, whose fathers and mothers have been off into all kinds of situations, who live with all kinds of people, and need to have a decent education in order to live in our society. There's a lot of other things that I could say to you. Sometimes I feel like when I go to these kinds of sessions and I listen at the anti-information being given out, it just really, it hurts my heart. Because we don't need to lie to each other. We do not need to lie to each other. We need to tell the truth, and we need to deal with the issues, and we need to help people. I'm committed to help people. I've learned a couple of things since I came to Cleveland in 51. I ran 5 times before I got into council. I had to fight every political structure to get there, but I went there with a commitment and that was to make a difference. There was a time when I wouldn't even vote for a white person, but after running into George Forbes, and you know George Forbes, who's a black man in Cleveland, who told me I couldn't come to council, and I said, you ain't God. When I got there, I've been committed that I don't, it doesn't matter to me what a color person is now, it's about the character, what that individual's character is. If that character is no good, then whatever you touch and do is no good. We need to have people who are concerned about educating children. We've got the kind of character that can sit down and look at the art and come up with the best plan. And I tell you, I'm a product of it. I can stand here and talk to you all day about it. Because it's a sin and a shame that we got to talk about which way government dollars go in this city. The Cleveland Public School System pays $9,000 a year, more than $9,000 a year, to educate the child. About $2,000 they get to the child. They're in the school system 4 hours a day. How can you get educated 4 hours a day? They're on the street at 9:30 in the morning, waiting on buses, and they're out at 2:30. How can you get educated? The discipline is bad. And teachers, we're burning our teachers out because we're not putting any help in the classroom. We now have a principal who wants to do something, but now she's talking about how to keep from pushing all the youngsters out in the street and send them home, and I think I hear a cloud of rumbling about her because she wants to make a change. Folks don't want change in Cleveland when it comes to education because they want to keep the money with the politics so they can control it. And God didn't put us down here to be controlled. He put us down here to do and work for each other where we can. Thank you.
Okay, we've got about 15 or 20 minutes for questions, comments, response, discussion. So we may have some members of the panel who want to participate with each other, or we may want to just take some questions from the audience. Who has a question? Yes, sir.
Mr. Martin, you probably feel a little bit like a Christian in a den of lions here, and I'm going to be speaking in the next panel and will say a couple of things that will put me in the same position as you. But anyway, it's a hard question with a lot of charity. My dad was run out of Alabama in 1960 by the Ku Klux Klan, burned a cross in our lawn. My dad was involved in the civil rights struggle. When Ms. Lewis speaks, I remember everything I grew up with. And I remember that we would not have integrated public schools if it weren't for black Christian Southern leadership. Martin Luther King was in the Southern Christian leadership. I think back to the Civil War, if it hadn't been for religious motivations, we probably would not have had a war that ended slavery. So I'm really troubled because you're troubled. You're troubled by the anti-union sentiment. I understand that. You're troubled about what competition would do to public schools. I appreciate that. But when you're troubled by the religious motives of people who are for choice, that's what religious motives look like. It looks like a mother who believes it would be a sin against God Almighty for her children not to get an education. What do you mean, sir, when you say you're troubled by the religious motives in the battle for choice?
Obviously, people who are favorable to choice don't embrace all of those views. Some are interested in profits, some are interested in a better education, some are interested in sending their kids to church schools and so forth and so on. What troubles me is what I said, that as a taxpayer, I don't want to send my public tax dollars to somebody in Cleveland or anywhere else so that they can send their kid to a church school. If they want to send their kid to a church school, that's fine. Ohio already provides the most the greatest number of tax dollars for private parochial education as any state in the United States. And we've been doing that for some 20 years. We don't need to choose the path of taking our additional tax dollars, sending them over to parents so they can leave the public schools without ever addressing the issue of improving the public schools so that they can send their kids to, incidentally, another public school, but half of them are going to private schools that are already there to begin with. Now, that's ridiculous public policy, in my view. And obviously, I haven't changed my mind. I'm still not going to send my tax dollars to Cleveland so that people over there can do that. That's wrong. That's a wrong public policy, not only for people in Cleveland, it's wrong for the rest of us in the state. And I was using Ms. Lewis, who I had not met, but had heard about, only as a figurative way to get that point there. I had no idea.
Had no idea
about what it means. But I'm glad I did that because that got Fannie started. And what she's saying is representative of a certain slice of the of the pro-choice opinion. It's not generic, it's not universal, but it is a certain slice there, and you're addressing that, and I'm giving you my answer. I think in the long run, that is wrong. Now, in the South, we know, for instance, after the Civil War, where public education came very late to the South compared to the North, the prevailing attitude was, I ain't educating your brat. I ain't paying taxes to educate your brat. So it's taken a long time just to get the concept of public education for anybody in the South back during the 19th century. And I think we've made progress. But we have some serious choices to make as we look to the 21st century about how we go about educating our people so that they can function in a democratic society without tearing it apart. I have no problem with people who want to send their kids to a church school. They just can't do it with my tax dollars. That's all.
Let me address myself to that. There are 9 independent schools that open up in Cleveland that are not church schools. The reason why our school would not open up is because we wouldn't allow ourselves to be controlled. We want to be an independent school. I have our curriculum sitting here. We're going to do a K-12. We will do it. But nobody came to us and said, we had a day where you come and shop for schools. There were about 50 schools in Cleveland that were out there, independent schools, that wanted to get involved. But the cost of the political structure and what have you, Cleveland don't want independent schools. Charter schools are going to be the answer. And that's what we're moving toward now, to get charter schools that have parents, teachers, and what have you involved. They are like, you know, Brennan never should have been able to do what he did. But he was able to go up there and buy all of the slots and put them all in the Catholic school. So people, rather than send their children to public school, sent their children to Catholic school. And my grandkids was already there. The thing of it is that this school here sitting in Huff now, which will take over 400 and some youngsters that will soak up the vouchers, will be a school to educate children and will not be a religious or church school, as they say. Okay, so he had a choice to work with us if he hadn't wanted to. He know where we are. He knows me, but I don't know him, but now I do. Okay.
Yes, sir.
I'd just like to follow up on the question. I don't need to really answer the question. I think the question, well, let me give you my question. You still have not answered the question, what is wrong with somebody sending their child to a religious school? Now,
nothing.
You can say that. No, let me, you can say that anybody can send their child to a religious school as long as they come out with tax dollars. Unfortunately, a lot of people who want to send their children to religious schools can't afford to do it. So what is the advantage of a policy that forces some children to stay in public schools that long-term failures when their parents, for whatever reason they might have, might want to send them to a religious school? I don't understand from a public policy point of view what is the downside of that? What is wrong with it? Is there something harmful about being sent to a religious school?
Well, there's something harmful about the way in which we're going about it because, first of all, if you provided vouchers to poor people, most of them won't go to another school. they simply will not go there. That's plain hard truth of the matter. Okay? So when you provide the public tax dollar to allow some people in economic distress to send their children to a private school or a church school, you're doing it by arguing that it's going to help all of those people. It's not going to help them. The great majority of those youngsters and their families are going to continue to go to the neighborhood school right down the street in public school. That's a problem.
I'd just like to talk to what you're saying, Dale. I don't know why you think it is that low-income families would not, if they had the funds, go to a private school. I mean, having looked at the history of education, certainly there were cases, for instance, early 19th century England, where there were families who could not afford shoes for their kids, who fed their kids potatoes, nothing but potatoes, for two straight weeks, and nonetheless set their kids to fee-charging private schools, though there were government-subsidized schools in those same areas. In fact, most areas in the early 19th century where there were government-subsidized schools, there were places available because a lot of low-income parents didn't want them. Even though these schools existed, most low-income parents decided they would rather pay, though they had very limited incomes, for private schooling because they thought that schooling was better. I'd also like to address your point about not wanting to pay for someone else to go to religious schools. Now, personally, I have no objection to that myself.
Or private, right.
But I agree with you. I think it is unfortunate, and it may be a cause of religious tension in this country if people who don't wish to subsidize religious schools for others are forced to do so. But there are many ways of subsidizing the education of low-income families that don't require that. For instance, the tax credit program that Michigan will have on its ballot in 2000 allows people to make a choice. Either I can continue paying my taxes towards the public school system as I've been doing all along, or if I think the public schools are not doing a good job locally, I can send my tax dollars instead to a private scholarship granting organization that will distribute scholarships to low-income families. So no one is forced to donate scholarships which might be used at private or religious schools, but they have the option.
Let me put another twist on this. I think it's the Catholic schools that the people are concerned about. And I'm sure that's what it is. It's the Catholic schools. And I find that as being real anti. That is very anti. And Catholic schools are where, and the reason why I say that, because I've heard it and I keep hearing it, but the Catholic schools are the only schools that could get open in Cleveland. Brennan got them open. The nine public schools that did get open, we had three more that opened, but they had to close down because they didn't have the money to carry through for the next year. And that's why we haven't opened up, is because we want to make sure that we have money to carry through for the next year. We don't have to close down, but it's the Catholic school that people are concerned about the voucher going to. Now, all you have to do is to check the lobbyists down in Columbus, Washington, everywhere. The Catholic dioceses all over, and I know in Cleveland, get a handsome sum of money for the Catholic schools. They even get a part of the voucher because they I think it's $500 that goes to the Catholic school in order to tutor the youngsters. So it doesn't mean that they aren't going to get any money in order to help with the educational with their educational system. If I had the choice of sending my children to somewhere else and had the money, I would have sent them to Catholic school because I was right across the street from them, rather than to send them up to that zoological society where I had to go up there every day. I had nine schools in my ward. When segregation came up, they built schools on the south side of Superior, and then they tore down schools that was 20 years old that we could have did something with. So it's the Catholic school that they don't want these vouchers to be used in.
Okay.
Now, and until that is addressed, because I don't know no other religious school that children are going to in Cleveland.
I don't want them used in the Protestant schools either.
We don't have any in Cleveland. There are none in Cleveland.
We just got a couple more minutes. We could try to get another question here. Yes, sir.
Right now we have a balance between religious liberty and factionalism in America. Liberty is you can choose to go to a private religious school, And we put a brake on factionalism by having a publicly supported public schools that, you know, I heard your example about prayer and evolution. There's a rough American consensus on those. There's a lot of argument, but I think most Americans are comfortable with this ideology. If there's a movement toward choice, I mean, I see Madison behind you, who is afraid of factionalism in America. And factionalism, at least in the European tradition from which we come, was what destroyed European societies. You did mention, for example, England during the period when Catholics and Protestants routinely burned each other. It was horrible factionalism. Isn't this a radical step that might bring America, might make us more atomized, get rid of the idea of communities? So she talked about Huff. When you hear her talk about Huff, there's a tremendous pride. She's fighting for Huff. If we atomize our society, break into factions and ideological factions, won't that create a different American, one that I don't think is that attractive?
Well, you seem to be assuming that a free market in education, where parents can choose any school for their kids, is going to lead to factionalism and discord. I've looked at 2,500 years of historical evidence. And while there are cases where there's been some discord in free markets, generally state-run school systems have been much worse. The turmoil you speak of between Anglicans and reformers in England was much worse when the school system was dominated by official government Anglican schools. Those are the schools that discriminated against nonconformists. And it was, in fact, schools led by nonconformists who were legally prohibited from teaching because of their religious beliefs that first opened their doors to people from all religions. And the reason they opened their doors to people from all religions was because they needed to make a living. They needed to teach people. And there were Anglicans who, though they had subsidized Anglican schools, chose not to send their kids there because they didn't think the education was very good. I mean, some people were very happy with them, but there others were not. And it was these private schools that began first to really offer a sort of non-sectarian education. And in fact, non-conformist schools became far less sectarian than the government Anglican schools. Really, I've seen that pattern repeated everywhere throughout history. When you let people get the things they want, and you let them also pursue the things that they share in common, and we share a great many things in common in this country, as you say, the sort of tension that you're worried about just doesn't arise because no one is feeling put upon, and that what really causes the tension is coercion through government schools.
On that, we're going to have to close, but I'm sure the panelists will be able to stay around to talk about it. Thank you very much.